You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's become something of a cliche to note in the wake of the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression that none of the people responsible have been held accountable or sent to jail. At the same time, the United States prison population, made up of predominantly poor people, is the largest in the world and continues to grow. First Look Media's Matt Taibbi went in search of an explanation for those two facts and to learn whether they are connected, and he discovered that our country has essentially two justice systems, one that pretty much protects the rich and powerful, and another that's less forgiving of the poor and the weak. His new book is called The Divide: American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Matt Taibbi was here in April to discuss it, and we are re-airing that interview for you now. Now, he called the two systems of justice in America, and I'm going to quote, dystopia where common city courts become factories for turning people into prisoners, while federal prosecutors on the white-collar beat turn into overpriced garbage men who, behind closed doors, quietly dispose of the sins of the rich for a fee.
That's great. You picked out my favorite line in the whole book.
Now, has it always been that way?
No, I think this is kind of a new thing. I think one of the things that I found really interesting when I was researching this book is that I interviewed a lot of people who were federal prosecutors who had worked in the justice system, in the regulatory system for decades. And prosecutors, by and large, are prosecutors. The best ones all have the same kind of personality. They know once they get their sights on their target, they want to get their man. They want to put him behind bars. They want to put him behind the wall. But this new kind of species of person has started to inhabit the justice system, who has much more of a defense lawyer's mentality, and they're deal makers as opposed to these aggressive bulldogs who are out for justice at all costs.
Well, there have been cycles in this country. The robber barons got away with all sorts of things, and then I guess we got tough after Teddy Roosevelt. Then we got tough again with FDR. I guess we have to have a Roosevelt in the White House.
I guess so. But, you know, again, even with the robber barons, there's a mitigating factor there, which is that they did something. I mean, no matter what you want to say about the robber barons, those people are often compared to the leaders of the Wall Street companies today and the heads of the pharmaceutical companies. They built something. They built the railroads. They built this country. Whereas, particularly in the financial services sector, most of the new schemes that we're talking about that have garnered the attention of the regulatory system, they are completely non-productive. Their entire purpose is to separate people from their money, and they are not the kind of people who you would want to make excuses for.
On the other hand, the wealthy can afford really good lawyers. We can't blame it all on the prosecutors, can we? And the courts have been rather friendly to the wealthy these days.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So it's everybody's on board?
Well, look, there are a variety of factors that have resulted in our getting to the situation that we're in right now. It's not all just, you know, people in the Justice Department want to let the rich off and they want to put poor people in jail. It's much more complicated than that. And of course, one of the big reasons is bureaucracies just tend organically to flow to where it's easiest. And it's very easy to put poor people and drug dealers and people like that in jail because they're poorly defended, because juries understand the crimes very easily, because there's a lot of political pressure to put that sort of person in jail. On the flip side, if you want to, you know, prosecutors have finite resources. If they want to, you know, take somebody to court for municipal bond bid rigging or the LIBOR scandal or whatever it is, they might have to assign 50% of their budget. They might have to spend 10 years, you know, beating back motion after motion after motion, and they might still lose in the end.
And because they often complain that these are hard things to explain to juries.
They're incredibly hard things to explain to juries. And again, I've told the story a few times, but I was at a case involving bid rigging, an incredibly complex financial chicanery case that involved all of the biggest financial companies in America, and they were basically hoodwinking all of the cities and towns all over the country. And the defense lawyer got up, and he didn't even try to make an argument against the facts. What he really basically said was, "Look, when you have if your washing machine breaks, you have to call a repairman. He comes and he tells you what the price is because he knows, and you don't." And this is the same thing. We know how all this stuff works. You don't know how it works, so we're going to tell you how much it costs, and you should just accept it. And the reason they can say stuff like that is because of the complexity, because people can't – it's too hard for them to go through doing all that work.
And then every once in a while, someone like Michael Lewis publishes a book, and people say, oh, boy.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, of course.
We've been screwed.
Yeah, no, but think about how long it
and
took.
And it's not against the law.
And it's not against the law. But I mean, you know, the high-frequency trading that he's talking about in that book that Michael Lewis is talking about, it's preposterous that there hasn't been action on that issue for years and years and years. It's computerized insider trading. That's really all it is. There's nobody on Wall Street who will come to you and say, you know, with a real defense of any of that. They'll tell you all the reasons that it's good for their company. They'll tell you all the reasons why it makes money for Wall Street. But they won't ever say high-frequency trading helps the ordinary person who has a mutual fund and invests through a broker at a strip mall.
You describe a vast extra-democratic mechanism at work in modern America. So this has to do with what we've been discussing, and at the same time, a poor person having to depend often on a public defender who has 100 cases that he or she is juggling and perhaps meets the defendant in the courtroom for the first time.
Oh, absolutely. I witnessed this firsthand over and over again. I mean, there's a scene in this book that I spent a lot of time on where, a young man that I spent a lot of time with, this guy Andrew Brown, who lives in Bedford-Stuyvesant, he was arrested for essentially standing in front of his own house. The summons says obstructing pedestrian traffic. You know, he's a bus driver. He had come home. He stopped in front of his house to talk to his friends. And it was just him and one other person, and the policeman just didn't like the fact that he was there, gave him a summons.
But didn't he have a previous arrest record? That often works against you.
He did have a previous arrest record, but you know he had gone straight a long time ago. This had nothing to do with that. This was just – it was basically being black on a Friday night. That's what the crime was. He goes to court, and he's trying to explain to his own lawyer – right? I mean, this is the court-appointed attorney. He's like, I am not pleading to this offense because I am not guilty, because I have the right to stand in front of my own house. And the attorney originally says he had offered $50 for a settlement. And when Andrew made that speech to him, he goes, well, how about 25? In other words, it doesn't register to these people that there can be injustice, that you can actually fight it. And this is the kind of thing that people who are in the system, they deal with all the time.
My guest is Matt Taibbi. His latest book is The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Do you think that the economic and policing differences in New York City exemplify this divide that you're describing in this book?
Yeah, there's a reason why I spent a lot of time in New York City in this book. And part of that is because the financial services sector so predominantly takes place in this city. So many of the misdeeds that we're writing about, whether it's the subprime mortgage crisis, whether it's other kinds of fraud, whether it's market manipulation, it's here. And so I wanted to sort of highlight the differences between how the segment of the population that works in lower Manhattan and how everybody else in the city, how they're treated by the justice system. And I think the most graphic demonstration, of course, is the HSBC case, where, you know, here's the largest bank in Europe. They get caught laundering, among other things, scads of other offenses. They're laundering $850 million for a pair of Central and South American drug cartels.
Also Russian mafia money.
Oh, Russian mafia money.
Tax cheating.
Yeah, tax cheating. You know, the suspected
They weren't good
terrorists.
To me when I banked there. I left.
Maybe you should have represented that you did something else for a living.
I left for another criminal institution.
But they get caught for all this stuff. They admit it. Right. You know, I mean, that's part of the settlement process. They're like, okay, you got us. We laundered all that money. And what's the punishment? A total walk. You know, it's a deferred prosecution. Nobody does a day in jail. No individual pays any penalty. And on that same day, New York City, you know, they're making this announcement in New York City that they're taking this fine and they're letting this company off. And that same day, the city is sending all kinds of people to jail for the most trivial drug offenses possible. I mean, these are people who committed the worst kinds of drug offenses. They were laundering money for the worst people. They were in direct contact with the worst drug dealers, and they got off. And yet somebody who's smoking a joint in the street goes to Rikers.
Well, how much of this is just is real policy? Early in the book, you describe a memo written by Eric Holder in 1999 that's called Bringing Criminal Charges Against Corporations. You call it a revolutionary manifesto.
Right, yeah, like a lot of manifestos. I think it was sort of an accidental revolution. Eric Holder back then was an official in the Clinton Justice Department. And at the time, it was viewed as sort of a get tough on corporate crime document. There were a lot of things in there that gave prosecutors tools to go after corporate offenders. But at the very end of the document, he created something that was called the collateral consequences policy. And essentially what this means is if you're dealing with a corporate offender that, say, employs a lot of people, and if you were to charge them criminally, lots of jobs would be lost and innocent people would be affected. You can take that into consideration. You can consider the collateral consequences and you can seek other remedies. You can go after fines. You can do deferred prosecutions. And basically what he's saying is that's okay. You can do that. And now this has become sort of the official policy of the land.
And that's what was applied in the HSBC case. But I don't understand why if you send a couple of people who are responsible for the policies that led to the money laundering to jail, how that affects all the other jobs that are part of the collateral consequences thinking.
Yeah, I don't understand it either. It's a sleight of hand trick, basically. I mean, the outlines of collateral consequences make a lot of sense. I mean,
is this like the butterfly effect thing?
Essentially now that's what they're saying is that if we proceed criminally against someone from HSBC, we don't know what the impact of that will be around the world. You know, the butterfly beats its wings here in New York City in a courtroom.
Chaos theory of economics.
That's exactly what – I mean, they literally came out and said this. They had press conferences. They testified before Congress, and they said, we just don't know what will happen if we move against these companies. And so, therefore, we didn't move against these companies.
Well, HSBC is an international corporation. Mm-hmm. Have they been punished anywhere else?
No, I don't think they have. UBS, which they also had a settlement at the time. There was a single felony indictment of a Japanese subsidiary, and there were a couple of former UBS employees who've been indicted.
Well, there was a LIBOR scandal that they were involved.
That was the LIBOR scandal they were involved with. And again, the LIBOR scandal is the biggest scandal in the history of financial scandals, and it involved upwards of $300 or $400 trillion of financial products. So, I mean, how can you have nobody go to jail for that? Right. Nobody do even a day in jail. And you have people who are in jail right here in New York City, all over the country for stealing, $200 or $300 for reaching into a till at a liquor store. It doesn't make any sense. It's completely unequal.
Well, they should go to jail for reaching into the till at the liquor store.
Yeah.
But reaching into the till, the bigger till, I guess it's a matter of how large the till is and how much money you take out before you wind up being okay and being protected by something called collateral consequences.
Right, right. Basically, they've drawn sort of this existential distinction between certain kinds of crimes. If they're small enough and they're easy enough to understand and there aren't any consequences if we put that person in jail, well, let's go after that person. But if it's big, then let's think about it.
Well, the fines are big. They are meant to hurt the company. Wouldn't that cause collateral consequences? Because to pay nearly $2 billion, HSBC had to find the money somewhere, and I'm assuming they fired some people.
So HSBC, the $1.9 billion fine, just to put that in perspective, that was 5 weeks of revenue for that company. Chase last year.
Cost of doing business?
Yeah, it's the cost of doing business. Last year, Chase got hit with a $13 billion settlement, right? The biggest settlement in the history of settlements by a factor of, four? Because, the previous biggest one was the BP settlement. I guess it was a factor of three. What was their response? They laid off 7,500 lower-level employees, and they gave the CEO a 74% raise. What's important to remember about all these fines is, yes, they achieve some level of retribution, but they never come out of the pocket of the actual malefactor. The person who actually did wrong never suffers. He never has to pay money out of his own pocket. It always comes out of the pockets of the shareholders, out of the company, and it's really nobody's money that gets paid in the end.
My guest is Matt Taibbi. He was a contributing editor for Rolling Stone for many years and has written a number of books, including a couple of New York Times bestsellers, The Great Derangement and Griftopia. Now he is with First Look Media, and his latest book is The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. It is published by Spiegel and Grau. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with a repeat broadcast of a conversation I had with Matt Taibbi in April to discuss his book, The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. I asked him, you don't have many kind words for Lanny Breuer, who brokered and announced the agreement between HSBC and the Justice Department. Do you see him as part of the problem?
Yeah, Lanny Breuer was the head of the criminal division under Eric Holder, and I spoke to a lot of people about him, and he kind of represents the phenomenon that I was talking about before. In the old days, the people in the Justice Department who made cases, and especially in the criminal division, they were prosecutors. They were people who just their whole being was about putting bad guys in jail. And it didn't matter what they were, rich, poor, black, white, whatever. That's typical profile of a prosecutor. And they come up through the ranks that way. Lanny Breuer represented this different kind of creature. He came from the corporate defense world. He had worked at Covington and Burling, the same firm that Eric Holder had worked for. He was famous for representing the high-profile targets of congressional investigations. I believe he had represented Roger Clemens, as a matter of fact, in the steroid investigation. And his entire way of looking at things, you know, I talked to a lot of people in the DOJ, and there was a tremendous amount of disillusionment among the prosecutorial ranks, because the new way of looking at things was, let's only make cases that we can be absolutely sure we can win.
So it has to be totally egregious, like Bernie Madoff?
And Madoff had the additional thing going for him, which is that he ripped off other rich people. So he has no lobby. If we're going to go after him, we're not going to deal with any political problems. If we go after, you know, some of the banks that we're talking about, there are several problems that we're going to deal with. Number one, the cases are hard to prove. No matter how much documentary evidence we have, it's hard to get juries up to speed about them. Number two, there's going to be tremendous political pressure on us. If we miss, we're all going to lose our jobs, right? There's that. And then number three, they're all going to be heavily defended, and everything that we do, we're going to face a dozen motions, and it's going to take forever for us to get into court. And so let's not do that unless we're sure we can win.
It's been charged that Elliot Spitzer was brought down partly as an act of revenge for going after some of these people.
Sure, and especially AIG and a connected case called the Jan Rhee case. I wrote about that case in the book. That case is a classic example of what terrifies prosecutors today. In that case, General Reinsurance was a firm that had been charged with a $750 million stock fraud. AIG was also a target in that investigation. Hank Greenberg, the head of AIG, was also a target. They got convictions against five people from January in that case, and it took a long time.
But they were fairly low level, weren't they?
Well, they were important executives, and if they had pressured them enough, they may have rolled over and got some very big fish in that case. But two big things happened in that case. One, the judge allowed them to stay out of jail pending appeal. So now all of a sudden you lose your leverage to pressure these people to cooperate with the government. And then the second thing that happened was the judge released them all on a technicality later. He essentially said that the state had been prejudicial in mentioning AIG during the financial crisis. it turns out the way I see it, he got his dates wrong, actually, that you know, that wouldn't have been prejudicing the jury at that time. But this is what terrifies prosecutors. Look, we're going to go after this big company. We're going to go after this huge target. And even if we get a conviction, the judge might leave him out of jail, and we might lose, and we might get the case overturned, even if we win.
In this book, you also write about Lehman Brothers. You call it the greatest bank robbery you've never heard of.
Yeah. No, this is a case.
Willie Sutton wasn't running the company.
Yeah, exactly. Why
are we still trying to get to the bottom of the story that goes all the way back to 2008?
Well, I just thought the story was really representative of a lot of things that are difficult about trying to police Wall Street. So much of it happens in the dark. So much of it happens with high-speed lawyering. And again, with a lot of these cases, possession is 9/10 of the law. Once something is done, it's very, very hard to undo. In the case of Lehman Brothers, there were accusations that were very well supported by evidence that insiders within Lehman Brothers took cushy jobs from Barclays, which was going to acquire the company, before the merger, before the acquisition, marked down the assets of Lehman Brothers so that it would be cheaper for Barclays to acquire, thereby robbing the creditors out of more money. Now, this bankruptcy happened at light speed. It happened in the middle of the financial crisis. The judge couldn't possibly have considered all these things at the time. But when they subsequently discovered all this evidence, it was too late by then. It was really too late to open that can of worms, and there was no law that obviously applied to what had happened. It would have been hard to make a criminal case out of any of it.
Did people who had money in Lehman and lost it all, was it impossible for them to get any of it back?
It was harder, certainly, because of what happened.
I mean, couldn't they just go to Barclays and say, it's now your problem?
Well, it's like any bankruptcy. There's a line, and however much money is left over for the creditors, that's, you know, whether it's 1/10 of what of the total allotment, you get your share, but that's all you're going to get.
So you're saying Dick Fuld perhaps should have been tried?
Dick Fuld, you know, walked away from this company with, you know, somewhere between $300 and $500 million in personal earnings, and none of that went to people who lost their shirts in the Lehman debacle. This is again a persistent theme of the financial crisis: is that the people who blew up these companies with their incredibly irresponsible behavior, they walked away with their money, and they didn't have to give any of it back. And in addition to that, the punchline is that none of them faced charges, or none of them had to deal with any regulatory issues.
My guest is Matt Taibbi. His latest book, The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. It is published by Spiegel & Grau. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You're also critical of the media, which used to be filled, you say, with middle-class ascetic cranks who hated everyone and dressed like over-caffeinated Jesuits. What are they like now?
I mean, this is my personal experience. You know, I grew up in journalism. My dad was a journalist, so everybody I knew growing up was a journalist. And I used to hang around newsrooms.
They drank a lot too, didn't they?
They drank a lot. They, you know, and back then, and maybe even before my father's time, journalists, you know, they came into the business. They might have been 16, 17 years old. They came in as copy boys. It was a trade. It was more like plumbing or carpentry than it was like a profession. And it tended to be populated by these sort of middle class people who kind of relished their role as cranks who every now and then got to stick it to the man, you know. And then there was a transformation in the business, and maybe it happened after Woodward and Bernstein. Maybe it happened in the late 80s during the Clinton years and, you know, early 90s. But suddenly you started to see a lot of Ivy League types enter the profession. And instead of wanting to stick it to the people in power, there was a definite vibe of, we like to hang out with people who are powerful politicians. I was very struck in the last presidential campaign. Actually, it was the one before that. There was the McCain-Obama race, when in the press section of the plane for Obama, there were the whole section was plastered with photos with reporters, and each one of them had taken a shot with their arm around the candidate. And that, you would never have seen that in 1976.
Well, selfies are now being banned.
So, right, yeah, exactly.
According to the Huffington Post anyway. But when people who have been caught with their hand in the till become news stories, often on the cable shows, people come to their defense.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Instead of saying, instead of being defenders of the public, they seem to be defenders of the people who they're covering.
Yeah, no, that's exactly the case. I mean, you know, look what happened when Jamie Dimon got his raise, and this was a striking moment in the history of journalism. Right, here's a guy who was the CEO of a company that got. Again, the biggest settlement in the history of settlements happened under his watch. And the Salon writer Alex Perrine very aptly pointed out that if he was a head of a restaurant and he had gotten the biggest settlement, the biggest fine in the history of restaurants, nobody would say this guy was doing a great job. But the financial press was saying, Jamie Dimon does great for J.P. Morgan Chase. He makes a ton of money for his company. Why would anybody want to remove him from office? It's crazy to even suggest that. And the people who did suggest it faced accusations from people in the media like, you're just bitter. You're upset because you don't make enough money, as much money as Jamie Dimon. And
who does?
Right. Yeah. And who does? No, I mean, I don't know anybody who does. I don't know 50 people who do. There's this attitude by journalists now that anybody who goes after people who have a lot of money, that they have a personal problem.
You also visited Rikers Island for this book.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's interesting. Crime rates have actually gone down, although our prison population continues to grow,
mm-hmm.
and poverty continues to grow. Usually there is some other kind of correlation at work.
Yeah, no, it's very strange. The decline in violent crime in America is a genuine statistical mystery that nobody seems to be able to unravel. It started happening in the early 90s. Some people attribute it to the new sort of statistics-based policing strategies that we've seen in all the big cities, the broken windows theory, but it really predated that, actually. I mean, we started to see this drop even before that. And what we have now is we have this enormous population of people who are going to jail, and when they start entering the criminal justice system, it's always for something dumb. You know, it's for riding a bike the wrong way down the sidewalk, or carrying an open container, or obstructing pedestrian traffic. And then they're in the system, and the next time around when they get caught for something, it's more serious.
Well, you write about a program in San Diego called Project 100%, or P100. And they go after people who are welfare recipients?
Yeah, this is a remarkable program where the concept behind it was, in order to stave off welfare fraud, we are going to preemptively search your home to make sure that you're not lying in your welfare application. So
they go through the underwear drawer of a Vietnamese woman who had recently applied for public assistance?
Yeah, exactly.
What were they hoping to find in her underwear drawer?
It's evidence that she was living with a man. So this is a frequent way that you lose your welfare. You show up at the welfare office and they see you get out of the car with a man driving. And you may have represented in your welfare application that you're a single mother with no other source of income. Well, if they think that you have some guy who's giving you cash under the table, you lose your welfare. You lose it forever.
How many cheats have they turned up?
You know, not enough to justify this program, let's put it that way. I mean, look, people do cheat on welfare. It happens, and it's regrettable, and it should be punished. I'm not saying that's not the case. And there are a lot of people who systematically cheat the welfare system, and those people are, you know, as low as you can get. But the people that I interviewed, by and large, you don't apply for welfare unless you're absolutely, you know, as desperate as a person can be. To have to go through the additional indignity of having a law enforcement official preemptively search your house and look through your toothbrushes and your underwear drawer is outrageous to me.
You write, ironically, the very brokest people in America, Hispanic immigrants, are one of America's last great cash crops.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because after the Secure Communities Act, which is an immigration law that went under effect during the Obama administration, essentially deputized the entire law enforcement network of the United States to become agents of the Immigration Service. So if you get caught fishing without a license by a game warden somewhere in Georgia, that person has the right to put an immigration hold on you, check your status, hold you for a period of time, and then turn you over to ICE, which in turn will put you into a detention system, which is enormously profitable for private companies, and is a lot of those companies are the fastest growing stocks on Wall Street.
You point out that while all of those P100 investigations of welfare recipients were happening, companies like Countrywide were perpetrating $26 billion of fraud, but that not one home was searched in those cases. No banker ever had someone pick up his underwear by a pencil and wave it in his face.
Right. No, exactly. I mean, think about the Countrywide case. I mean, Countrywide was a company that nearly blew up the universe. And they pioneered this technique of basically giving out mortgages to anything with a pulse. I mean, they were so bad. I talked to one whistleblower at the company that when he was a quality control guy, he got hired. He shows up at the company. One of the first things he sees is a fancy car in the driveway with a personalized license plate that says Fundum. In other words, we give mortgages to everybody. So they pioneered this practice of giving away bad mortgages all over the country, and there's no consequences.
So in the end, what do you see as the consequence of this? Are we moving in a direction where the country gets worse and worse, or are we hearing from any legislators that we're seeing some serious problems? As they did react to the Michael Lewis book, I don't know where the laws will result, but do you think that we'll ever be able to retip the balance?
I'm skeptical. I mean, I think that the number one thing that I took away from this book was not so much the statistical changes, not so much all these different cases that didn't happen. It's the psychological change that's happened with America, the fact that people aren't outraged anymore. I mean, 10, 15 years ago when we had Tyco, Adelphia, WorldCom, Enron, you know, the Bush administration went out of their way to put those people on trial, and they felt that it was necessary to do that. And we've stopped feeling like it's necessary to keep up appearances.
This is the new normal.
This is the new normal.
Perhaps because we're also fatigued.
Yeah, everybody, of course, has corruption fatigue now, but that's very dangerous for this country, you know. When we start thinking it's okay for some people to go to jail and other people just don't go to jail, that's weird and terrible.
Matt Taibbi is now with First Look Media, along with Rolling Stone. His latest book, "The Divide: American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap," it is published by Spiegel and Grau. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thanks for having me, Leonard.